From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is much that I love about religious tradition, says our guest tonight, Elaine Pagels, and much that I cannot love. And one of the things Elaine Pagels does not love about Christianity is its traditional orthodoxy. Early followers of Jesus of Nazareth were not always of one mind, she says. Multiple gospels were written. Some were later championed by the emerging church. Other accounts were banished as heretical, only to reappear centuries later. Elaine Pagels has spent much of her distinguished career digging into the account of Jesus and his teaching left by the Apostle Thomas and comparing it with the Bible's New Testament gospels. The accounts are different. Tonight on Point, Elaine Pagels on the Gospel of Thomas and how it speaks to nearly 2,000 years of Orthodox Christian thought and tradition. Are you prepared to consider another gospel? And how should a religion handle unearthed texts that speak in a different voice, convey a different view? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Elaine Pagels, professor of religion at Princeton. Her first book on early Christianity, The Gnostic Gospels, received the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's a recipient of the MacArthur Prize. Her new book is Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. Good evening and welcome, Elaine Pagels.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. There's so much we need to learn about this. Take us right in with that spot in Upper Egypt where the Nag Hammadi Library showed up in 1945. What was that? What was its significance?
Well, it's a very surprising discovery. Nobody anticipated that in 1945, a Bedouin villager named Muhammad Ali in Upper Egypt was digging for fertilizer for his crops, and he came upon a 6-foot jar hidden in the sand. And he dug it up and found that there were 13 ancient books in it. These books had belonged in an ancient monastery. In fact, it's the oldest monastery in Egypt, one of the oldest monasteries. And he discovered that one of the first texts in that gospel, in that book, is the Gospel of Thomas, and with it the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Truth, the Secret Book of John, the Prayer of the Apostle Paul, and over 50 ancient Christian texts that we simply hadn't known about because they had been buried there for 1,600 years.
You've paid a lot of attention to these, and we're going to get around to looking at how ultimately, these texts intersected with your own life and belief, some tragedy and some insight. But give us the basics here first. Who was Thomas exactly?
Thomas, according to the New Testament Gospels, is one of the 12 disciples of Jesus. In most of the New Testament Gospels, he's just a name on a list. In the Gospel of John, he becomes a character. But this claims to be a gospel of secret sayings of Jesus entrusted to Thomas. Let me just say that I was as surprised as anybody when I first came upon this gospel. I'd gone to graduate school to study the beginning of Christianity, and it never occurred to me that there would be anything but, you know, any but four gospels in that tradition. So I was totally surprised when my professors were reading gospels that I'd never heard about. They had file cabinets full of gospels, which were completely new to most of us.
Is there any doubt that these are genuine, that they were actually written? Well, you tell us when, that they are, in fact, the work of contemporaries of Jesus, contemporaries of the other gospel writers?
Well, the fact is we really can't tell exactly when they were written or where they were written. So, yes, there's certainly doubt about that, and there's probably doubt also about the Gospels in the New Testament. We don't know, you know, historically who wrote them. Tradition tells us that they're written by the Gospels, by the disciples of Matthew or John, or disciples of the disciples like Luke and Mark, mm-hmm. But we don't actually know who wrote them, and we don't know exactly when. It's hard to date them.
So when you sit with these and compare them to the other Gospels, is it a leap of faith to think that these all speak with some kind of connection to actual events, or is there a reason archaeologically or historically to think that these are equally, I'm not sure what the word is, authentic as the Gospels in the Bible?
Well, it's a good question, and how we you know, how we're going to call them authentic is a question. First of all, when the Gospel of Thomas was discovered, the editors who first published it assumed that it was heresy, as we'd always been told. So they said, well, this must be a very late gospel. It must be, you know, 50 years after the others. And that's what they wrote. Secondly, some people started looking at it and they said, wait a minute, the sayings in the Gospel of Thomas, some of them are identical with sayings in the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Matthew. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when they began to study analytically, so this isn't a leap of faith, this is years of research, they began to study and compare them and say, wait a minute, the versions of the teaching of Jesus that occur in Thomas look not only very early, for example, they look very much like Luke's versions, but they sometimes, in some cases, look like they're even earlier versions. In some cases, Luke looks earlier. These are matters of literary analysis.
That leads me to want to be reminded of the origin of all the Gospels. When were they written? What's known about the history of the Gospels and how they came together so that we can see this Gospel of Thomas in that context?
Well, that's a good question. Nothing was written during the lifetime of Jesus, so far as we know. But we know that the Gospel of Mark is probably the earliest. Well, we know it's earlier than Matthew and Luke because both the author of Matthew and Luke, both authors used Mark in their Gospels. Mm-hmm. If you look, you can tell that the whole of the Gospel of Mark is in Matthew and the whole of the Gospel of Mark is in Luke. And both of them also have other sayings that are identical. So Mark was written, we think, about 40 years after the death of Jesus. Matthew and Luke, most people think 50 or 60. The Gospel of John, maybe 60 or 70. And the Gospel of Thomas, people have different guesses. Professor Helmut Kester at Harvard University suggests that it's the earliest of the Gospels that we have because he thinks it corresponds to an early list of sayings that's incorporated into Matthew and Luke. I have a more conservative dating, really, and suggest that it's probably written at least by the end of the first century.
What are the distinctive characteristics of the Gospel of Thomas?
First of all, it opens with the words, "These are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke and which the twin Judas Thomas wrote down."
The twin now, Judas Thomas?
Yes, it says, well, Thomas is an Aramaic nickname, really. It means twin. And Didymus is also twin, so they call him Didymus Judas Thomas. His given name was Judas, but they called him the twin.
Judas then, or this is a different Judas?
No, they always say Judas, not Iscariot. It's another Judas, but they just called him Thomas.
Mm-hmm. So this is Doubting Thomas, not the Judas with the kiss.
Yes, John called it the Doubting Thomas. Mm-hmm. But what's distinctive here, you see, is that the Gospels of Matthew and Mark and Luke are never said to be secret. This one says these are secret sayings. And what I think they suppose is that you know the story of Jesus, because if you didn't, it wouldn't make any sense. I mean, what would the sayings of Jesus, I mean, what difference would it make?
Why should these be secret if the others were not?
That's a good question. And some of these, as I said, they're just the same as Matthew and Luke. They'll say things like, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven," or the parable of the pearl, the parable of the fisherman, the parable of the sower went out to sow. Mm-hmm. But they do seem, there are other sayings that are very mysterious and hard to understand. And the idea is here that they're kind of mysterious sayings that you have to discover for yourself. The second saying, according to the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, whoever seeks will find, and whoever seeks will be astonished and will be troubled. And so the idea is that one has to enter into a process of attempting to understand the sayings of Jesus, and it can be a very disturbing process and a very exciting process.
That point around seeking is where you hold the Gospel of Thomas up against John, the book, the Gospel of John, which you describe as having become over time the predominant gospel. And here's where, Elaine Pagels, you begin to contrast the message of the Gospels that made it into the New Testament and the Bible with at least this one that did not.
Well, yes, all of us who are working on these texts are very puzzled. We're trying to say, well, how is it, you know, how is it like the New Testament Gospels and how is it different? And I finally came to see that this doesn't have a story in it. It doesn't tell you anything about the birth of Jesus, about miracles. It doesn't have anything about the death of Jesus, the resurrection. But it just has sayings, which I think are meant to supplement what you, say, a believer, already know about Jesus. But while the other Gospels ask you for faith, this one assumes that you're going beyond faith to understanding. St. Augustine talked about faith seeking understanding, and that's the same process that this kind of text suggests. It's not a surprise it would be found in a monastery, because monks were people who devoted themselves to going beyond sort of ordinary belief to deeper understanding.
So what's the significance of in Thomas, if a reader then follows it beyond faith, as you describe it, to understanding, is it conveying something that the other Gospels do not?
Yes, and that's why I called the book Beyond Belief. It wasn't just a flip title. I was really talking about how can we get beyond thinking that belief is the only element about Christianity. Because many people, if they say, well, are you a Christian? And if you ask them, well, what do you mean by that? They'll say, well, do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? So if you say yes or no to that, that's all it takes. I mean, you're either a Christian or not.
As the determining yes or no. Mm-hmm.
Yes. But there are many other elements. And this is a collection of sayings that talks about coming to know who you are, and it's coming to understand who you are. It's not an intellectual process. It's a matter of knowing in the heart. So it has to do with experiential ways of coming to know God and verify what you know.
So John goes for the belief vein. Thomas goes for the seeking vein. Could you boil it down to that?
That's part of it, and it's a good way to put it. Again, Professor Helmut Kester at Harvard, who has studied this considerably, suggests that the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of John really are drawing on similar teachings of Jesus, but they take them in different directions. The Gospel of Thomas says that Jesus speaks as the divine light that comes from the beginning of creation. A beautiful saying in the Gospel of Thomas goes like this. Jesus says, I am the light that is before all things. I am all things. All things come forth from me. All things return to me. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up a rock, and you will find me. So this suggests that Jesus speaks as if he were a voice from the light of the universe, from the divine light that pervades the whole universe, not just human beings, but stars and stones and logs.
Well, you make a distinction there, as I read you, Elaine Pagels, saying that in John, Jesus is described as the sole source of this light. In Thomas, the light is spread around. It's in every human being.
Exactly. That's really the crux of the difference. I came to the conclusion, which really surprised me, that the author of the Gospel of John was writing knowing the kind of teaching there is in Thomas and believing that it's been taken in exactly the wrong direction. Because the Gospel of Thomas says not only is Jesus one who speaks from the divine light, but the good news is so are you. And so, according to the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, if people say to you, where do you come from? Say, we come from the light, the place where the light came into being in the beginning. And if they say, who are you? Say, we are children of the light, living God.
As you describe it, this makes belief less important than acknowledgement of that shared light.
Yes, it's knowing that your source is from God. And this is not an awareness that's considered obvious at all. I mean, most people are completely unaware that they come from that divine source. It's a kind of awareness that has to be discovered. The Gospel of John, though, just as you said, says, yes, Jesus comes from the divine light at the beginning of the world. That's the good news. But the bad news is that you and I do not. And we live in a world of complete darkness and sin. And apart from Jesus, we are completely lost. Because, as you said, he is the only source of light in the universe.
We'll come back and talk about this. But when the church began to organize as a real institution some centuries later, that view held by John there was much more adhesive. I mean, it required that people believe what was given by the church.
Well, it's a really interesting question you're raising about one was chosen and not the other to become a basic part of Christian tradition.
And one ended up in a 6-foot jar up the Nile. Eileen Pagels, stand by. We're talking tonight about the lost Gospel of Thomas and the new light it throws on the traditions and practice of Christianity. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to admit another gospel into your thinking about Christianity, about Jesus? What do you make of the so-called Gospel of Thomas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the lost Gospel of Thomas and the new light it throws on the traditions and practice of Christianity with Eileen Pagels. She's professor of religion at Princeton University and author of the new book, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. You can join the conversation. Is it helpful to go back to lost early documents and reconsider religious tradition? Or does it just muddy the waters? Does it take us into that area of heresy? Could it be that a gospel denounced as heresy almost 1,700 years ago is actually critical to understanding Christianity? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Eileen Pagels, I wish you'd put this in a personal context for us. You describe quite openly in the book some of your struggles, your attraction to and struggles with Christianity over many years, and how studying these so-called Gnostic Gospels has actually helped you in your relationship with this particular religion.
Well, that's very true. I think everybody who investigates the beginning of Christianity does so probably for similar personal reasons, that we want to figure out what relationship we have to them. I grew up in a Protestant Christian family. I found, you know, Christian churches and music very powerful in many ways. At a certain point, when I was an adolescent, I fell out of love with it because I was told by various Christians that my friend who was Jewish and wasn't born again was going to go to hell.
This is when your friend died in an automobile accident.
That's right. And it was shocking and very painful to be told that at the age of 16. And so I left. I just said, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't believe that. So I thought if I went... When I went to college, I thought, well, maybe if I just try to read these Gospels in Greek, I could get closer to them. Then, you know, that's a very ancient belief. So I started to do that. I found them absolutely fascinating. And I certainly wasn't expecting when I went to graduate school to see any other Gospels.
But you did.
I did. And when I did, I was sort of taken aback. Wait a minute, I wasn't looking for these. I was looking for something simpler and clearer and, you know, way back there that would sort of explain it all. And instead, the picture became much more complicated. All of us realized, and somewhat with dismay, that the early Christian movement was complex and diverse in ways that we absolutely didn't expect. And now I feel that this demonstrates that we have to explore these traditions, at least I do. And, you know, the question, do I have to believe all of that? For me, is answered, no, you can't possibly believe, you know, everything that 300 years later is put into the Christian creeds. I mean, it's fine as poetry. It's fine as a hymn. If you have to sit down and struggle with every word of it, many of the words don't even make sense to me.
Boy, here you go. You give somebody a great education. The first thing you know, they start asking questions, even about the basic
That's
creed.
Right. That's right.
A lot of learning is a dangerous thing here. We see Eileen Pagels. What is the response you get from the Christian community, from Christian churches, to this kind of interpretation? I mean, once something's pronounced heretical, is that supposed to be the end of it, or are people open to, you know, to a conversation about texts that went away for an awfully long time?
Well, you say, what is the response of the Christian churches? You know, and we often talk as if there were only one, but of course there are many.
Well, I carefully made it plural on further consideration there.
Well, that's right. There's everything from Pentecostalist churches, Roman Catholic churches, Russian Orthodox churches and Episcopal churches, Baptist churches. So Christians all over the world have different ways of organizing and different, you know, sense of what really matters. I think what matters to me very much is communities gathered for worship that share values, that share the conviction that loving one another is fundamental to this tradition, that share baptism and the sacred meal, the story of Jesus, the life and death of Jesus. That seems to me really deeply what this tradition is about.
But certain things are fairly fundamental. The Nicene Creed, you talk about the history leading up to that. Maybe you can share that with us, how as the church, the original church, began to coalesce toward the time of Constantine, you got some basic creeds that were to be shared by everyone, and Thomas may lie outside them. How did that history unfold?
Well, that's quite fascinating. There were developing statements of faith, and some leaders of the church who thought it was too complicated and too challenging to have this many groups and different teachers teaching different things, thought you have to get a basic common denominator. What do we all believe if we are Christians? And they tried to work that out in a simple framework, particularly because it was an illegal religion. It was being brutally persecuted by the Roman state. And so they began to formulate these and say, well, let's just take four Gospels and all the others, we're going to throw those out and say they're illegitimate. And that's what happened. Some of the bishops and some of the archbishops in the 4th century decided that some of the writings in the early Christian community were fine. Bishop Athanasius of Egypt said to the monks, you can take 27 of these writings and throw the rest away. Those are all heresy. Mm. And the 27 that he lists is the first list we have of the so-called New Testament collection.
There it is, and that became the touchstone for everything that followed, and they were quite effective in pushing all the other texts out of the picture.
They were enormously effective because by the time Athanasius was a bishop, the emperor was astonishingly a Christian.
Constantine.
And he had police power as well as military power behind him. And the emperor was very much interested in unifying the empire. One part of that unification involved acknowledging that all Christians should believe exactly the same thing. He required the bishops to meet and make a creed.
And the Nicene Creed you're talking
exactly
about there. Mm. We're talking tonight with Elaine Pagels. She's author of Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. She's professor of religion at Princeton University. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Gracie's calling from Franklin, Massachusetts. Hi, Gracie. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling because I disagree with you. I think that
you disagree with me about.
Oh, I disagree with Elaine, the professor.
With me.
Uh-huh, got it.
Okay.
I think that if you look at the Gospel of Thomas, we can all agree it's a Gnostic gospel, and that when the Church formed the canon, it was because when you take the New Testament and the Old Testament and read it as a whole, the books that they've included witness the truth of Jesus, and they communicate the truth best to every generation. The Gospel of Thomas. And Jesus appears not as a real person, but, his significance isn't in how he lived and how he interacted with those around him, but in, like, this light that you speak of. I mean, if you simplify everything down to this light and darkness that's in every person, then you're not actually taking, how you live and how you act as, your means for salvation. Not to say that your Jewish friend isn't saved, because none of us know who is saved, truly. But by simplifying everything to light and dark, you get no clear picture.
Gracie, I want to get Elaine Pagel's response to that, but let me ask you first. It sounds as though you're well-versed in this material. Are you then open to accepting that the Gospel of Thomas was written at that time, even though it's not clearly accepted as part of the biblical church teaching?
Well, I go to a Catholic high school, uh-huh. and so I've been taking religion classes for 6 years. But I do accept that the Gospel of Thomas was written written shortly after the four Gospels. I believe that obviously Gospel of John mm-hmm. was written later, but Gospel of Thomas would be after that, in my opinion.
And the idea to you then is that this is just not as high a quality an interpretation of the significance of Jesus, and the Church determined that?
The four Gospels, I think, perfectly, or to the best of our ability, everything that we found besides those four Gospels don't show the true picture of Jesus when you combine it with the thorough study of the Old and New Testament as two parts to the whole picture of the Messiah.
Gracie, stand by. I want to get Elaine Pagel's response. Elaine? Okay.
Well, it's an interesting thing that you're saying, that the true picture of Jesus, as the Church later proclaims that truth, is that he is the divine being. That is, he is God in person. And that is true, that is what Orthodoxy says, and Thomas says something somewhat different, not that he isn't a divine presence speaking, but that the divine presence speaks through everyone. So you're right, it's quite different. Whether Whether it's consistent with the whole revelation is, I guess, a matter we could discuss.
Gracia, are you even open to that conversation, or is it all, it's all done with you? You've studied it in school, you've got your understanding of Christianity, and that's it.
I'm pretty, I've done a little study of, I will admit that I am not a total expert, but from like what I've read through analysis of the gospel, the four gospels and Thomas, why it might not have been included, I just don't feel that Gnosticism in general is just a split faction from true Christian identity, and that in the early part of the last 2,000 years, it was really just a side thing and heresy that led Christians away from true belief of Jesus. And in fact, you know, just wasn't a good thing.
Gracie, we've got it.
I would like to respond to that, actually, because that's an interesting point that Gracie raises, that these are called Gnostic Gospels. I called them that, too. I assumed they were heretical when I started reading them. And I would now not call it that because I'm not convinced. I mean, Gnosticism is a name for a kind of heresy that I don't find in this text, nor do I find it in the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, which is about to be republished by Karen King at Harvard University. I think it's more a question about church authority, but that is also a subject that many church leaders do not want anyone to raise.
Well, that gets to the nub of it, doesn't it? I mean, you describe, as I read Beyond Belief, Elaine Pagels, this kind of winnowing of texts as a way of the church asserting authority. Now, here we are all these centuries later, and many people have fully accepted that authority. I assume most Christians to some extent, and I can imagine many listening to you tonight and saying, well, who are you to say what's heretical and what's not heretical? If it's heretical, it's heretical.
Well, that's a very good question. I certainly wouldn't have said it had I not been confronted with this problem in graduate school and very puzzled because, you know, suddenly we had all these other gospels. Now, how do we evaluate any of them? This is the question that these discoveries raise for us, and I find that study absolutely fascinating because it does put into question what makes a gospel a gospel? What do we mean by authentic? What do we think that Jesus actually taught?
It also gets to the character of the Christian church and whether it's authority-centered or something else, doesn't it?
Yes. One of the things you find in the Gospel of Thomas is this theme about verifying for yourself what is true. And I think that that suggestion that everyone needs to seek and find for oneself is not the message that many leaders of the church wanted to have broadcast.
Then or now, Jacques calling from Ringe, New Hampshire. Hi, Jacques. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Great show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment and have the guest maybe give her idea of this.
Sure.
As far as I've known or believe that it wasn't the church so much that excluded the Gospel of Thomas, but that the Gospel of Thomas essentially excluded itself because of some of the sayings. And the guest actually brought up one of them, being split wood and I am there, lift up a stone and you will find me there. As far as I was concerned, the church took that as sort of a statement of pantheism where Jesus or God was sort of one with nature rather than apart from nature. And the second, the Gospel of Thomas ends by saying, let Mary go away from us, because women are not worthy of life. For every woman who makes herself male will enter into the kingdom of heaven. And as far as I knew, these kind of statements go so far against what the typical four Gospels have to say about Jesus that's really why the Gospel wasn't included.
Jacques, let's get a response from Elaine Pagels. Elaine?
That's a very good point. I mean, it's true that the saying about, you know, split a piece of wood and I am there, lift up a rock and you will find me, suggests that the presence of God is available not just in Jesus, not just in the church, but in every person and in all creation. And that certainly is different from Orthodoxy. That's true. The statement at the end of the Gospel of Thomas is actually a statement by the disciple Peter, tell Mary to leave us because she is a woman and not worthy of the life. Actually, in the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, you find that Mary is teaching and Peter says, did Jesus really speak to a woman and not to us? I mean, this is very offensive, the idea that this woman, Mary Magdalene, could have been a disciple. In the New Testament Gospels, the women are the women and the disciples are the disciples, but women aren't disciples and disciples aren't women. In these other texts, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Philip, and the Gospel of Thomas, you do find that actually some of these women are also disciples. And that is also offensive to many people in the church.
Jacques, thanks for calling. Elaine Pickles, I need you to dive back into how these different versions may have emerged. You've studied this, and many and others have for years now. It's confusing to me, and I wonder how what the interpretations are. Why different tellings? I mean, of course, we all know. We've all played telephone. You know, you whisper something,
yes.
It comes out the other end differently. But did people come to the aftermath of the time of Jesus with different agendas? Did they have some predetermined outcome or worldview that they wanted this man or this divinity, depending how you look at it, to be remembered for?
Well, it's a good question, but if you think about it, you think about Jesus's teaching. He didn't write anything as far as we know. So he taught, he spoke. And many people remembered things that he spoke. Some people wrote down things that he spoke. You can see that somebody wrote them down, and you'll find them in the Gospel of Matthew and Luke and Thomas, the same things. But it's not unusual to think that different people would have chosen and selected a different kind of collection of the teachings of Jesus. This is true in the Gospel of Mark, and it's true in the Gospel of John in the New Testament. It's also true in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. Now, I'm not saying these are all of equal value, whatever we mean by that, because, you see, when I first encountered them, I assumed they were heresy, just as other people have. And now I think these were considered to be supplemental. So I suggest that most Christians would have known the story that the Gospel of Mark tells and accepted it. But the Gospel of Mark does not suggest that Jesus is a divine being. It suggests that he's a man who's the Messiah, the Son of God, the one chosen to be the future ruler in the new kingdom of God.
Many of those phrases you just used are, I think, in common usage by many Christians today, understood as indicating divinity.
That's exactly right. But in the first century, the language of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as one of the fathers of the church says, are not the language of divinity. Their language about a human being who God has chosen for a special purpose. It's the Gospel of John that speaks of Jesus as a divine being. And yet, I, like most people who grew up with these traditions, thought that all the Gospels actually say the same thing. That's the way we're taught them.
So if the Gospel of Thomas had been included, would the Christian church be something different today?
I think it might be something different. I think it might be more like the Orthodox churches, like the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, the Coptic, in the sense that there would be well-known traditions that everybody knows and uses, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And there would also be, if you like, mystical teachings, some of which you find in the Gospel of Thomas. That is a pattern in some of these other churches. Where you have a closed canon, the picture becomes somewhat different. I'm not suggesting that the Orthodox churches have not now closed the canon, because I believe they have.
Elaine Pagels, stand by. Elaine Pagels' new book is Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. We're talking about the lost Gospel of Thomas and the new light it throws on the traditions and practice of Christianity. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you ready to admit another gospel into your thinking about Christianity, about Jesus, and what do you make of the so-called Gospel of Thomas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the lost Gospel of Thomas and the new light it throws on the traditions and practice of Christianity. My guest is Elaine Pagels. She's professor of religion at Princeton University and has spent years studying the so-called Gnostic Gospels. Her new book is Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. You can join the conversation. Is it helpful to go back to lost early documents and reconsider religious tradition, or does it just muddy the waters? And could it be that a gospel denounced as heresy almost 1,700 years ago is actually critical to understanding Christianity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rolf is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Rolf. You're on the air.
Hello there.
Good evening.
Yes. I read Elaine's books, they're good. Adam, Eve, and the serpent is a classic. Here's my question. In Saying 100, it says, give Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Give God the things that are God's. And what is mine, give to me. I think that verse proves the Gospel of Thomas is the oldest gospel because Jesus is saying he's a man, not a God.
And why does that make it sound like the oldest to you, Rolf?
Because I think that Jesus was a great man, a great, great man, who became glorified into a God over a period of a couple generations.
Are you a Christian?
I've been confirmed as a Lutheran. My middle name is Christian. I grew up in a Christian family. I believe in the basic moral tenets of Christianity, love your neighbor. But I'm not really a Christian as far as, like, believing in... I'm a follower of Galileo, not
got it, but it's interesting because I hear the kind of fulcrum in your thinking about it being right there around this issue of belief. I mean, if you personally concluded from reading Elaine Pagels and others that this was a man, does that in your mind then, Rolf, mean that you cannot be a Christian?
Well, maybe I'm not a Christian, according to a lot of people, but I believe in a lot of things that Christians do. But I don't believe in supernatural because I believe in science. But something happened when Jesus lived, because how do you explain the fact that the teachings of Jesus became the most influential teachings in the whole history of the world, unless maybe you say science is more influential?
Elaine Pagels, you've got a kind of soulmate in this reader. Speak to Rolf.
Yes, thank you for your comment. I mean, first of all, I want to say, you know, it's not news that there were many Gospels in the early Christian communities. We always knew that because that's what the fathers of the church have always said. What's news is that we actually know what some of them are because all the others were called heretical and destroyed. And just as you say, Rolf, the Gospels that any New Testament scholar, most New Testament scholars at least that I know, everyone I can think of, would agree are the earliest are the Gospels of Mark, Matthew, and Luke. And they do not suggest, according to the way most scholars read them, that Jesus was a God, but rather that he was a man, a prophet, a teacher, a rabbi, a king, an inspired person. But the Gospel of John, which most of us think is later than those, does speak of him as a God, and also Paul's letters, which are very early. So we know that this question was disputed in the early Christian movement. But I think, Tom, you're absolutely right that not all Christians believe that Jesus was, in that sense, a God or God. They did share the values of the community, the teachings of Jesus. I was looking today at a second century Christian teacher who said, when we find people who hear the teachings of Jesus and agree to live accordingly, we baptize them. I thought, now that's a lot harder. Agreeing to live according to the teachings of Jesus is a lot harder than believing in a creed.
But the creed has been the defining line and remains so for a long, long time. Rolf, thanks very much for your call. Karen's calling from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
What's on your mind, Karen?
Okay, I just tuned in, and I, you know, just from the part that I heard, I find it really exciting if you consider the possibility of what this message is, because I think that it moves religion away from an intellectualism and away from beliefs to another possibility where it's maybe about what a human being is and how do you experience, you know, what it's like to be human, and I think referring to the light.
That's a major shift you're describing. Away from belief, does that to you mean it makes it more in tune with what it means to be human? Why, Karen?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the reason that there's, I mean, I think if you look at it, it's like what's the possibility that somebody was here who maybe could teach people something about themselves and that wasn't intellectual, where there was some kind of an experience that made them love and that made them happy? What if that's happened all over the world in many different generations, and what if there have been these great teachers that have come that have been able to teach this? I think it's much more unifying than my religion, your religion, and I think it's much more about the message than about the person who delivers the message.
Karen, thanks for your call. It's terrific. Elaine Pagels.
Yes, I'd like to say that I'm not saying that the creeds don't matter, and I'm not saying that belief doesn't matter, but I'm saying that for most of Christianity, that's been the center, and that's been all that's mattered. Now, when you look at the early Christian communities, there were Christians for 300 years before there was a Nicene Creed, 320 years. So what I'm beginning to think is that there are other elements of this movement that do have to do, as I said, with shared worship, with a shared conviction, faith in God, shared values about human beings and their value, that may matter enormously. And also, just as she said, a sense of experiential ways of knowing God. It's not that belief is a mistake at all, but most beliefs we can verify. For example, if you believe in a person, your faith in that person can be verified or disproven. And in this way, the Gospel of Thomas also speaks about verifying the truth of what you understand about God and about yourself.
Elaine Pagels, you write about the lives of early Christians before it was all about belief, how Christianity was expressed in lifestyle, how radical it was. Can you give us a sense of that?
Yes, it was very radical, and I felt that I rediscovered it one day when in a time of terrible need, because my two-year-old was terminally ill, I walked into a church in New York and saw people that were gathered into an extended family with a sense of spiritual power and spiritual purpose, sharing the sense of loving one another and caring for one another. That's very powerful. That matters to me a great deal. And that's what Christian faith was about. What the African church father Tertullian said, people we used to say about these Christians is, look how they love one another. He said they were amazed that these people loved one another and they took care of one another. They buried the dead. They fed the hungry. They visited the sick. That's what they did.
It spoke to you when you had a child who was dying, and it held them together before there was even a church. Sarah's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. What a wonderful program. Thank you very much for having Elaine Pagels on.
Quite welcome.
I read her book, her translation. I don't know. Did she translate it? I guess. Anyway, I read it when I was young, and now I'm an old lady, have lived a lot. And, you know, last week at church, because I still go to church, mm-hmm. even though I've also meditated and followed, I think, partly from Thomas himself, who says, keep seeking and you mm-hmm. will be troubled. Mm-hmm. Yes. And actually, my meditation threw me into therapy. And then I got a lot better.
Through seeking.
And yes, through seeking. Through seeking. And that's what meditation is. And, you know, they say that when one-third of the world meditates, we will have peace in the world. Because we will do what Elaine Pagels just described about how Christians love one another.
But Sarah, after all that seeking and meditation, when you listen or read Thomas today, do you see this as part of your Christian understanding of the world, or as a heresy outside that illuminates it, but is not part of it?
Not at all a heresy. I find it wonderful, and not at all pantheistic. Seek, 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 and ye shall find. And what if you are troubled? You will also learn to love. I had a child I lost, and that child came to earth to me, and she taught me how to love. You know, I have learned to be Christian through many sources. And God said, I mean, Jesus said, know ye not, ye are gods. I have never heard a minister preach on that statement. I wish I could quote which book it's from. It's one of the four Gospels. Know ye not, ye are gods. Now, that's a man speaking from that divine light.
Elaine Pagels, where is that from?
Actually, I must say, I don't know the saying. I think that's in the Psalms. But anyway, I must say, I also go to church, and I think that when one deals with that kind of loss, it's very hard to just rattle off a lot of things in which you believe. Everything is opened up to question, and only what really stands the test is what you can trust at that point.
It's
but I think there's much to love about Christianity, and actually this work has helped me to to realize what I love about it.
Sarah, thanks for your call. And Sarah and Elaine Pagels, in everything you say, there's something, it's funny, you're quoting and citing an ancient text here, but there's something very modern in the unwillingness to be tethered to demands of belief. You know, we'll carve out our own way, thank you. We'll think our own thoughts, thank you. Is that ancient or modern or both, Elaine Pagels?
Well, let me say that I think it's ancient. I mean, some people, one person did a review of my book and called this text New Age, and I thought, well, it's 2,000 years old. That's not too new. But this suggestion of seek and you shall find is also in the Gospel of Matthew. The suggestion that the kingdom of God is within you is also in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 17, verse 21. There's very little in the Gospel of Thomas that isn't echoed in other sources, but what you don't find is the conviction that there is only one way to be saved, and that is by believing in Jesus. I do suggest to you that that's not something that's been in the Christian movement necessarily from the beginning, and certainly not universally. When you look at the history, you see that all of this developed in different communities in very different ways.
Anne's calling from Boston. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted a wonderful program, and I wanted to tell you that Elaine Pagels' book just absolutely blew me away when I read it. And I was so struck by the Christ within, in the sort of like the Buddhist quality of this Thomas Gospel. And a gospel that is talking about Christ within and the focus on loving one another, which I find so missing, despite the talk, in so many of the fundamentalist Christians, that we can do war, but the love one another part is so absent.
But it's fundamental to the message in the Bible. Why do you think it takes, to your mind, the Gospel of Thomas to pull that out, Anne?
Because I think what she addressed to me is the part of how John's talking about the divine Christ, when divinely inspired, I think could sing to people in this era. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another thing about this book, is that there were so many hungry, lapsed Christians that I wish there was a church of Thomas or a place to go where these ideas could be explored.
Got it. And our time is short, but thank you very much for your call. Elaine Pagels, that raises an interesting point. Does Thomas ever get preached from a Christian pulpit, or is it still really off limits? It's secular academics like yourself that write and talk about it.
Well, that's very interesting. It's many people in the churches who hear this most deeply, I think, and many people who've been out of churches too. This book is being discussed now in churches all over this country and all over the world, I think, when this is, it's very much opening up questions that I do think we need to open up. It's not just that we can close them down or we're not doing it out of idle curiosity. These texts were found and we have to try to figure out.
But what do you think? I guess there's no precedent over such a long time, but do doors like this open again once they're closed? It's a long time ago this was pronounced heresy. Is that a one-way street?
Absolutely. The question is, who pronounced it that and for what reasons? And, you know, that's one of the things the book explores. It also shows that people in the second century read the Gospel of Thomas, the letters of Paul, the Gospel of John, the Gospels of Matthew, Luke, and the Gospel of Philip, read them all together without a problem. These sources are different. They say somewhat different things, but they could be read as congenial.
Who read it out and why? Elaine Pagels, fascinating speaking with you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Elaine Pagels is the author of Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.